Babylon 5, at its core, is a five-year history, from this year to this year. But life continues in either direction. And the fans want to know what happened over here and what happened over here. And if there were things that could be done without messing up this story, I thought, well, let's show that part of it.
In my world, there are books, thousands of pages, about the power of one mind to change the universe.
Got it. It's right here. It's right here.
Do not thump the book of Shaquan. It is disrespectful.
This is still the Babylon Project podcast.
The year is 2021.
The place, the Babylon Project podcast.
Hello there, Babylon 5 fans. Welcome to our next, and actually in this case, it really is, fairly exciting episode of the Babylon Project podcast. This is Raul Wybera talking to you with my good friends J.P. Harvey and Jim Arrowwood. How are you two gentlemen tonight?
Greetings. Doing pretty good.
I'm excited about this book.
Yes, this book. With this book, the Babylon 5 novels are essentially reset. I think the next one might carry a little bit of baggage from earlier. But, you know, I kept telling you guys, just hang in there. It's going to get better. Well, from here on out, it is a whole different world where the book series is concerned.
I don't know. The next one, you know, if you look at the formula from what the cover looks like and the formula of the statement on the back. And I mean, yeah, we're spoiling here. What the hell? But it looks like we're going to go back down the rabbit hole.
Like
again,
I said, like I said, this book will carry, this next book, I believe, carry some of the old baggage.
Yeah. But the one after that will be excellent.
Yeah.
I know that because I've read it already. I read it before.
And the three trilogies as well.
Yes.
And so, we are talking in vagaries here. Yes. JP, what is the book we're talking about tonight?
Well, it's called The Shadow Within, and it was authored by Jean, I would guess is her first name.
Jean
Cavellos.
Okay. Now, I know that name from the Babylon 5 universe.
She might have wrote a few more books. So yeah, if you want the backstory on this book, I can run through that real quick. This one came out in 1997 in April, as always published by Dell, 278 pages, and it was the first of four novels that she wrote in this universe, at least four that I could track down. The other three were a trilogy, one of the three trilogies that we'll cover later, called The Passing of the Techno Mages.
Which were actually more popular than even this one.
Yeah, and this one was pretty good. This novel is set in 2257. So for those that want to align this with the television series, it would either be immediately before season one, or it would be the thing that actually would have begun the first season, the events happening just before the series pilot called The Gathering.
Right, and remember, The Gathering occurred 1 year before season one officially started.
Yeah, so, and this one, I'll save that comment for later. Because I've done this with the other novels, or most of them, since we haven't talked about this one yet, the publication date of this means the author should have had access to the first three seasons and perhaps part of the fourth season to help inform what she wrote about the book or the characters. It is considered canon. This is one that JMS himself said holds that status. So of the first, what is this, number seven that we're on? The first six were not canon, were informed by JMS, but we're not canon. This one is actually canon. canon. So, and I think we'll see why it fits very well.
A piece of trivia.
Very well into the TV show.
A piece of trivia here. This book, as far as canonicity, is the first book where the author was able to talk to JMS directly during the writing.
Nice.
And you can really tell the difference. Yeah. In fact, she was even able to get an advanced copy of the script for the finale of season 3, where Sheridan went to when Melissa Gilbert guest starred and was able to go.
Yeah.
They went to Zahadum.
Hmm. I have a question.
That's awesome. And
is canonicity a word?
You just used it.
No. Raul used it.
Yeah, it's a word.
Okay. You know, I'm going to look it up later.
Well, if you don't find it, you're using the wrong dictionary.
Uh-huh.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Hey, the last little nugget about this, just interesting if true, is it relates to this whole declaration of the story being canon, is that apparently one site that I had read said that JMS had declared it to be canon in April of 97, which is when the book was published. So it sounds like she wrote it, you know, with involvement with him, and as it hit the bookshelves for people like us to go in and buy it, he made it abundantly clear that this was a legit.
Well, one of the things people will notice is that this story fits into the actual series in a way that none of the other books have.
Mm. Oh, yeah. One observation I would like to make, and that would be about the author, is that this author is American. Okay, and no, seriously, she is American, and the books that we have had the most problems with since we've started doing these standalone novels are the ones that were authored by citizens of other countries.
Namely the UK?
Yes. So I don't know if that really has any bearing or not, but... you know, it's just an observation that I made.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not a bad one.
It's definitely valid.
Yeah. So should I launch into a summary?
Yeah. Tell us about this book.
I was going to say, with this setup, we are ready for it.
Excellent.
Archive. Access. Initiated.
The electrifying space epic continues as Anna and John Sheridan battle deadly foes at opposite ends of the universe. The dedication of the new Babylon 5 station is fast approaching, and desperate enemies intend to see it end in catastrophe. The fate of the fledgling Space Alliance lies in the hands of John Sheridan, newly appointed captain of the EAS Agamemnon. His orders are to stop the attack until he gets to the bottom of the near mutinous behavior of the Agamemnon's unruly crew. Sheridan and his ship will share Babylon 5's doom. Time is also running out for his wife, Anna, headed to Zahadum aboard the Icarus. Young, beautiful, and brilliant, she was thrilled to be appointed chief science officer of the follow-up mission to this mysterious planet on the edge of the unknown universe, where artifacts rumored to hold stupendous powers have been discovered. But the offer she could not resist threatens to become a dark destiny she cannot avoid. For an unimaginable horror lies somnolent on Zahadum, and the monstrous consequences of disturbing the sleeping evil will haunt every living thing in the cosmos. Well, there it is.
Actually, isn't the problem that they're no longer somnolent?
Well, yeah, but I didn't write the thing.
Yeah, sort of wakey wakey.
I didn't write the thing.
Oh, God.
At any rate.
That's a lot of summary. And somehow Cavellos packs
And the summary doesn't do the story justice. It's
not even
close. It's not a bad summary at all. but it doesn't really give you the flavor of what this book is.
Yep.
Yeah.
This book, well, first of all, the summary, like as you say, I think a big part of the issue with this summary is that it kind of gets things backwards. Sheridan is really the B story. It's very, very much secondary to what's going on. It's there to provide contrast, you know, both the husband-wife contrast and what he's doing in the big timeline contrast. Mm-hmm. The real story is Anna's story, which is something that fans have been asking about since we very first heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you what, this book is what I had hoped and expected from a Babylon 5 novel series. We already know where it has to go, you know, because it's you have to respect the events that have happened in the series. What's important here is that journey. And in making the journey, we actually, in this book, have the Babylon 5 universe expanded where the mythology is concerned. We have more finally than what looks like it was an abandoned script for a mediocre episode that wasn't good enough to make it on television. We had unexpected twist. We had a story that really fit into the canon. The writing was powerful. The story was moving. There may have been some retconning where one character was concerned, but you know, even that is very plausible and plausibly explained. And in my opinion, by far, this is the best book in the series up to this point.
Mm.
JP, what are your thoughts? Just on first impressions.
Huh. Yeah. Well, main stories here are backstories for some of our favorites. I really enjoyed the backstory for Anna and John, and frankly, even for Sinclair. I think I learned more, or got more color, if that's the right word, into the characters of Anna and John, though, than I did Sinclair. I didn't think there were any shocking revelations in here. It was just awesome. It was really good storytelling. Everything fit really well into the B5 universe that we and probably everybody else, you know, I assume everybody or almost everybody starts by watching the TV show, and this meshed really well with it. A lot of the earlier standalone novels, maybe all of them, I know I had commented that they felt like short stories that were jammed into a novel length, mm-hmm. right? That just there was too little story and too much book. In a lot of cases, they might have made a neat episode, or they might have made a neat novella. But a part of the problem I had with a lot of the earlier novels was that it was just not enough story for the volume. This one, I thought, could easily have been like a double episode if it had been on TV or even a movie. So, big yep. fan. I like this book. How about you, Jim?
Well, you know, I agree with everything you guys have said. You know, even though we all know the outcome of this story, it was still a great read. As far as John's story, it was interesting and entertaining, despite being somewhat predictable. Of course, we know what the ultimate outcome is going to be, but there wasn't a whole lot of mystery in there. You know, the reveal of what happened to Anna on Zahadum, what was the meat of this thing. And, you know, of all the standalone novels we've read, this is the best one so far as I'm concerned. And, you know, it gives me hope that that even better is still to come. Gene Cavalos raised the bar really high with this book. And the things that I really enjoyed, I mean, the things I really liked, was no weird conferences on the station, no riots, no Garibaldi running himself ragged, no weird entities, Amen. Yeah, no weird alien races that have goofy beliefs, as we have seen in previous stories. It's just a great Babylon 5 story, and wow, this would have made an incredible movie.
Yeah, you know, it really would have. But there's something nice about this one, being able to get into the characters' heads with the books, though. in a way that the movies really don't let you. And, you know, especially getting inside Anna's head.
Yeah.
Because that was a lot of it. If we can segue this to the characters, we're not even going to try and just go down a character list, but there are certainly some characters that are, you know, points that are worth bringing up. And like I said, a lot of this is just in Anna, and so much of it happens in her head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I found it odd, but I think this author wrote Anna better than Melissa Gilbert played her in some ways.
Yeah.
There was pieces about Melissa's portrayal that just seemed a little bit forced, I guess, in some ways.
Well, that's because we didn't know her. I mean, we had nothing on her. Plus,
uh-huh.
She wasn't playing Anna Sheridan. She was playing the shadow agent.
Yeah, that's true. And
so she wasn't even herself when she was herself.
She wasn't herself when she was herself. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Just on the flip side, I'll just leave it at this and the rest for the discussion. This John Sheridan was our John Sheridan, with a few years of, you know, less age and experience, but we got John Sheridan, I think, in some of the best way we had.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of background, the one background no one's mentioned is Dr. Morden.
Yeah.
Who'd have thunk you could feel sorry for that slime? Huh?
When we meet him initially in the show, he's always Mr.
Yep.
Or just Morden.
Or just Morden. You know, we never do find out his first name, even here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I thought when he was detained by Sheridan, the claim was that he was just a technician on the Icarus, rather than their PhD linguist,
yeah,
who apparently is rather comp. That's the part that I was talking about earlier. Might have been a retcon, and you know the fact that he was on television, he had some notoriety from the IO Jumpgate accident. But they even explained that, yes, you know, like by that time, you know, by that time in this book, the time in this book, no one even remembered who he was even after that. So
yeah.
It's sort of a no big deal.
Well, you know, and these are, Morden was part of a conspiracy theory, yep, kind of story that ran through both threads. Okay. Because we had several characters that were, somebody was doing something dirty, and we had all the usual suspects. Of course, we had Dr. Morden, uh-huh, we had Dr. Chang, we had Miss Donnie, the psychop assassin, we had Captain Hidalgo, and who is the bad guy? And, and then on Sheridan's side, we had the same thing. We had Corcoran, Ross, Spano, Whatley, and...
Even mm-hmm. Best, Captain Best.
Yeah.
Yep, as reference.
Was colored as a good guy or maybe not. So, right.
So these were threads that kind of ran through that gave you, okay, let's figure out who the problem is here. And, but it wasn't the main story. And then, of course, we had a foil, you know, General Locksman, mm-hmm, who was in there constantly biting Sheridan in the rear end.
I had a JP question for that, by the way. This is the one character I had the most trouble with, JP, okay? His ham-fisted reaction on that inspection, particularly and specifically considering the rather unusual and questionable circumstances, kind of made him a little harder to believe, I guess is how it would be put.
Yeah, it was, I just assumed the author wrote what she knew.
Uh-huh.
Is that yeah. Maybe that's not a great way to put it, but yeah, I wasn't distracted by it because...
No, I wasn't distracted, but it was the one piece.
Yeah. He came across it. Well, so two things with this cat. One was he came across as a kind of a disposable character, so I didn't get too entangled by the way that he behaved. The other was I viewed him when he showed up instead of some senator. I viewed him as that bigger EarthGov meanie that always seems to appear. Instead of it being a politician, though, it was a general.
Yeah.
It was clunky or awkward a little bit.
Well, yeah. The impression I got is, what? You've been in command 3 hours and you ain't got this place straightened up yet? What's the matter with you? Right. We're going to send you to the Russian
basically
front.
Basically threatening his career because he hasn't fixed a train wreck in a day.
Yeah. So.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, there's other character I have to point. Oh, sorry, JP. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I looked at that as he was a prop to do other things in the story. And one of those, I believe, was to show us more of Sheridan's character.
Yeah, in the vernacular.
His reaction to the general is what was more
what mattered.
Yeah. In the vernacular of my students, he was a tool.
Yeah, pretty much.
And we're not talking about
the band. No, 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 no. The band, I like the band.
Now, the other character I need to point out is Ms. Dunn, our psychop assassin with the fetishes. That comment about her, she finally looked at peace once she was dead.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Keep that in mind because I'm going to bring that up in a future novel. It kind of, you kind of get a similar sort of thing going on.
Okay. But yeah. So.
Yeah. But that's really all I've got to talk on the characters at this point because everything else about them is going to come out in the actual story discussion itself. Yeah.
Did you guys find it interesting as I did? How we danced around actually calling the shadows the shadows. The author.
But you had all these references to shadows.
Yes. But the author never, never named them shadows.
Yeah. No character ever said the shadows. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not their name for themselves. And I'm glad they didn't try to use their name for themselves because, as it was pointed out, 10,000. It's 10,000 characters long.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was happy with that as well, Rebel, that somebody didn't go, you know, it would have been kind of clumsy, I think, if it's like, you know, whatever this race is, you know, they're very shadowy. Maybe we should call them the shadows.
Dun, 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 dun.
she just left it alone. She worked, I mean, I'm going to bring this up, frankly, later is one of my favorite things about the book, but I really like how she gently just wove, as you said, Rebel, the word shadow. Or the use of real shadows into all of the scenes, or, you know, not every, literally every one, but all of the scenes or scenery that went around those creatures, you're getting the word shadow, you're getting description of shadows, darkness, and even at, well, I'll leave it. Now we'll get into my favorite quote, and I'm going to leave that. But, that was really neat.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Jim. It was neat how she did that. Or what was the word you used? It was intriguing or fascinating.
Yeah.
But
you know, and let's talk about the story, the stories themselves. The book basically breaks down into two stories. You have Anna's story and you have John's story. And as far as Babylon 5 characters are concerned, we have a few, but this author, again, to her credit, didn't try to jam everybody in there. So
the existing, you know, TV series cast that's used when they're used, they're strictly props to serve a specific purpose or to bring a particular context to the things that are happening with the main parts of the story.
Yeah. So we only
no more. No less.
We only had what was necessary, and that was really nice. Okay, so anyway, let's talk about John's story. So John, he's looking forward to vacation. He's been given command of the Agamemnon, and he comes on board and winds up having to cancel going to be with his wife because of some problems on the ship. And the
all of which we knew.
Yeah. Well, and his problems were with his weapons crews on the ship. Apparently,
primarily,
they did not operate very efficiently. And you know how it is in the Babylon 5 universe. You have to be ready, at least with weapons, all the time.
Yep.
So poor John.
Well, and if you're not drilled up and making sure everything is functioning right, you know, you've got the individual discipline. Bad things happen. You know, can happen. You know, you don't want to. You can't afford accidents when you've got that kind of dangerous ordnance.
Yeah. Well, and then John, he's looking into the problems, and he's finding that his weapons crews are full of malcontents.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you know, they don't want to cooperate. They don't care. They aren't going to be threatened or coerced into doing what they're supposed to do. And, you know, come to find out they're not really happy with having Sheridan for captain because they liked Captain Best.
Who basically ran, at least from appearances initially, ran the ship based on nepotism.
Yes, and it wasn't a great thing.
Plus, Captain Best had, let's face it, if they had the evidence, he would have been spaced for cowardice in the face of the enemy.
Mm-hmm. So all along...
Or his ship would have been destroyed.
Yeah. Mm. So all along this path, we're being shown these characters...
Like the other 19,800?
Yeah. We're being shown all these characters that don't want to cooperate. They don't want to do their jobs. And, but they aren't the real problem.
Nope.
Dun, dun, dun. So enter First Officer, who has been written to be a very, very fine officer and a really good guy, helping John all along the way.
His right arm through the entire story.
Yeah, he turns out to be the bad apple in the barrel because he is jealous that he did not get command, rather than Sheridan when Best was left the ship. Corcoran absolutely believed he was going to be appointed captain of the ship, and then they bring in Sheridan. And... he resents the fact that Sheridan is considered a war hero for his exploits.
half the crew does, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, they think he's going to be some hotshot egomaniac on a power trip. And but of course, we know that's not John Sheridan at all.
No.
Yeah.
Like I said, in this book, John Sheridan finally really is John Sheridan.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back on Babylon 5, we have the bad guys are going to blow the station up, okay? So we have lost Babylons 1 through 4, and now we're going to lose Babylon 5.
To Homeguard this time?
Yes. And
which is probably who was the saboteurs in the other cases, except for Babylon 4, of course.
Yeah. And Corcoran is the guy who sabotages the weapon systems on the Agamemnon, and repairs need to be made. So, so the other guys, they come around finally and say, oh yeah, well, we'll help you out here. And then they jump in and they start.
And they really put their lives on the line.
They did. And the repairs get made just in time for Nick. I mean, just in the nick of time. And Babylon 5 is saved. So, That's John's story in a nutshell.
Yep. And what Sheridan actually does in the saving of Babylon 5 turns out to be right in character with him because, I mean, basically, instead of ramming speed, it's drop the anchor in front of the other ship, basically.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Now, I was kind of hoping that JP would jump in here and talk about John Sheridan's command style and how he managed to get the guys who didn't want to work for him to work for him.
I liked it. It was, he wasn't a caricature. So, you know, always he's the hard-nosed General Patton, or he's a total softy. You know, he wanted to trust his troops. He expected high standards. I have two favorite quotes from the book, and one of them pertains to this.
One of mine's from that, too.
Yeah, so I enjoyed a lot watching how he reasoned through dealing with these three kids, I shouldn't call them kids, right? These young officers.
Yeah, one of them's not hardly a kid. Ross has been serving for years.
Yep. And they were, I thought, so credit to the author, they were the slackers that they were because they were allowed to be that way. He comes in to try and fix the problem, and he's dealing with not one, but three distinct personalities here, and she broke them apart well enough that they weren't just templates, right?
Mm-hmm.
But each one's kind of got their own issue, but together they're a problem.
Yep.
By the way, that's the vehicle to sneak Corcoran in, right? You're not paying any attention to him. But the tension there where toward the end of the badness of these guys, when he finally gets them to work, after he had locked one up, charged him with insubordination, as I recall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Dereliction of duty or insubordination.
With Spano.
I think the light came on. You can see the light come on in that young man's mind. Like, oh no, this is not me being lippy with a senior officer and getting away with it anymore. And then that fell well right into the circumstances of the sabotage. And as John lets them come out of the penalty box to help the one kid in particular.
Ross.
Cut him loose, put a suit on him and send him outside. And now you're watching the three light bulbs come on when these gentlemen realize this isn't a game. These aren't drills. Now there's a real problem. And it was neat to watch those guys kind of blossom, to bloom a little bit.
And Ross wasn't, John didn't send Ross out. In fact, he was giving Ross a way out. Ross says, no, I'm doing this. I'm the best one for this job. So damn it, I'm going to make it happen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was a part of, in my mind, how he built these as very distinct uh-huh. characters. They weren't just three bad eggs.
Yeah.
But it was nice, and really the question was about Sheridan, right, about his style. But I think that backstory on him, as I mentioned when we kicked off, that was a huge part of letting us see how he dealt with problems that were, frankly, very tactical. This is a commander mm-hmm. and three junior officers, as opposed to these, you know, these giant problems that we see him deal with when he's the commander of Babylon 5. But I thought he was very believable. Unlike the general, Sheridan's thinking and approach to how he's going to deal with this discipline issue was very believable.
You know, and Spano and Whatley, it really was a case of just a couple bad eggs that he was able to bring around. In Ross's case, there was a real underlying trauma that was kind of driving what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
It could have ended up with what had happened. It could have very easily ended up being a real tragedy and very, very close to did that, in fact. And this is one of the areas where we saw talking Ross down from killing himself was a very John Sheridan kind of moment.
Well, and see,
right,
that is what you said earlier, that when you said John Sheridan in this book was absolutely John Sheridan, she nailed
mm-hmm.
him. And it As we saw through the entire series for four seasons, Sheridan was a person who knew how to handle people.
Right.
He knew when he had to kick butt.
How to lead.
He kicked butt when he needed to, but he would also give pats on the back where they were deserved. And he was well liked for that. And, you know, Corcoran just never came around because Corcoran was blinded by his jealousy. And so, yeah, I really thought that it showed an example of leadership that is admirable.
What we got here that we can never get out of the TV show is in the TV episodes, we got to watch him be this guy. In the novel here, we got to watch him wrestle with how he was being that guy, right? Mm-hmm. What am I going to do with this fellow? Yeah. I should have charged him earlier. There's no time in TV to watch the thought process happen. You just watch John Sheridan be John Sheridan. Here we got to watch how it is that he dealt with things like that. It was neat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a good place to make the contrast because it's more on the captain of the ship sort of thing. I've been rereading, actually for the last third of it, reading for the first time, David Weber's Honor Harrington series, which is, in my opinion, the best military science fiction created, book or movie. And having to set aside the Honor Harrington books in order to pick up one of these Babylon 5 novels, especially having the memories of, you know, having read the series before, it was always a case of, oh gosh, I'm having to put down this wonderful material for this. In this case, no. And the reason I'm bringing it up here is Sheridan had to deal with some of the same problems that Harrington did, inheriting a ship that had and a post that had a bad history, and making something powerful out of it, good out of it. And he handled it in different ways, but it was engaging to read that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great.
Yeah. So should we move over to Anna's story?
Which I think is actually the A story.
Yeah. Anna is looking forward to vacation. She is anxious to get on vacation. John's anxious to go on vacation. They want to, you know, take a couple of weeks and be together before they go back to work. And John calls and tells Anna he's not going to make it. And she doesn't really feel very bad because what she doesn't tell John is that she has already accepted a position on the Icarus. So prior to that, she is experimenting with something that she calls a mouse, which described to me kind of looked like a piece of biotech of some sort. Mm-hmm. She didn't know what to
do. With that shadow modeling.
Yeah. And she didn't really know what to do with it, but she felt kind of a connection with it.
What was the line? I am the machine?
Yeah. And so they don't know, but when she holds it, it seems to her like it's communicating with her. So she decides that, well, maybe this thing is telepathic, and they call in this poor telepath. I don't recall his name off the top of my head, but they have some banter, Anna and this telepath, and he's a pretty nice guy. I mean, you know, he's a P5. He's gonna
Terrence or something like that, I think.
Yeah. But he's a P5, and yeah, he's a nice guy. They get along and they have coffee and visit and everything, and then he goes to scan this thing and it explodes in the lab. And basically kills him. Anna is saved from it, but...
Well, it turns his brain into jelly, basically.
Yeah. And...
him and every other P5 in about a 3-mile, I think she said, radius.
Yeah. So we definitely have some telepathic things going on here. And then a telepath shows up and to investigate. Doesn't learn very much from that thing. She doesn't even want to touch it.
Smart on her part there.
Yeah.
Like I said, it didn't just take out, it was Terrence Hilliard. It didn't just take him out, but it took, she says later in the book, basically points out that Anna's the biggest mass murderer of telepaths in human history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Chang calls Anna, offers her a position as first officer on the Icarus. They're going to a planet called Alpha Omega 3 to investigate.
Interesting name.
Yes. to investigate artifacts that may be there and ruins and things like that. And they jump on. They head to Alpha Omega 3.
Mm-hmm.
There's all this little maneuvering and stuff going on, and Anna doesn't know who to trust, and she hooks up with Dr. Morden. Now,
who turns out to be the one person she can trust.
Yeah, and hooking up is, I don't mean that in a physical way, but Morden was a nice guy.
Yeah. He was the one guy she could trust. He was the one good guy on that whole dang ship, basically.
Yeah.
Well, and hey, Anna was a nice lady.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And my, how things changed for both of these characters. Frankly, you know, we're looking back at Anna, and it makes her story even more tragic.
Yeah.
The story that we know from the series. But Morden, who we all love to hate, became a really tragic character because we just learned that he was a decent guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a decent guy. And one of the things that really made it really hit you is what the Shadows finally did to break Morden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to his wife and daughter's death.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he was a family guy. He, you know,
mm-hmm.
This is not at all.
Family was everything for him.
Yeah, it was not at all a dislikable person. Jeez, I'll tell you what, you got a feel for this guy, as you mentioned before, Raul. Yeah. That who'd have thought you'd ever feel bad for Morden?
Yep,
I didn't want to like him in this book, but I did. I didn't want, I guess, my hate. That's too strong a word, but I didn't want my hate to get spoiled. This guy was evil.
You wanted to dislike him.
And now we learn he's not evil. He became evil, and we got a glimpse into why. But
yeah,
Man, tough stuff. And then, by the way, since it's, you know, Anna's story, we knew that the love between her and John Sheridan was, you know, supreme. It was superior, probably as laudable as his career, right, and his attitude about service and all that. So watching her in the TV show, even only knowing the little nuggets we knew, it made it hard to see how bad she was. This book made it a tragedy because her love for John was written so well, that just the passion she had for her husband that was only equaled by her job, you know, by her love of science.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then to watch her fall, you know, just like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, one of the things I liked about the way her side of the story was written, I mean, you couldn't miss the kind of alien kind of theme to it in a way. You know, the model day and the way the crew's getting picked off one by one. I mean, there was in some ways a feel of alien to it, and I'm sorry, Anna Sheridan's no Ripley, but then again, she's a scientist. She's not supposed to be. And yeah, it really led you up to that fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you feel for these people. You know, I remember Anna Sheridan walking in as Delenn is coming out of the room, looking at the snow globe and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, can you imagine the feeling that John had when he saw her standing there. I mean, my goodness, because, you know, it's really, really fleshed out in this book. And you know what the real tragedy is? When you come down to the bottom of it, as I think of it, is it's all about money. It is not about scientific research. It is not about expanding knowledge.
Oh, gosh.
It is IPX trying to figure out a way to exploit this planet.
Speaking of Alien, the corporation, I don't think we ever get a name for it in the movie, but
yeah, we do, but I don't know what it is.
Mm.
But
same thing though.
Yeah. So it's IPX sending these sacrificial lambs out there, you know, and well, if they come back with discoveries, that's great. We get richer. If they don't, oh well, we've only lost a ship and a crew.
Right. Oh, you were talking some of the subtleties, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
How the shadows were never named. What about the subtlety, all of the foreshadowing throughout in Anna's story itself? I'm going to read a clip real quick. This is from about midway through the book. Anna felt blindly in front of her, pulled on the thick gloves. She did the digging manually. This is her controlling the remote, mm-hmm. right? A necessary precaution to preserve whatever was below. Here we go. As she moved her arms, the probe's metal arms moved, the flat spatula hands reaching down, scraping away a thin layer of rock fragments. The resistance of the rock against her hand registered as dull pressure. Here we go to them. It was an odd sensation, as if her body had been replaced by a machine body. She took care to record what she found at different depths, though the jagged fragments appeared fairly uniform. And then it comes a little later on, a couple pages later. And as she scanned the controls and panels and communications equipment surrounding her, it struck her. The machine had been the universe. And then you go to the end when they kind of plugged her into one of the shadow vessels.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the foreshadowing becomes the reality there. I thought it was just neat the way it was written. And this is just one example. There's a few other pieces through there where you see the same kind of foreshadowing. That's, you know, I am the machine sort of thought in that.
Mm-hmm. And JP, you were getting ready to say something.
Yeah. There was a quote really early in the book. I didn't have it down as one of my favorites, but it was a good quote about the corporate mindset.
Yeah.
Here, and then also in Alien, look at it here. Their interest in archaeology was perfectly summed up in the corporate slogan, exploiting the past to create a better future. As mm-hmm. long as the better future was better for IPX. Or as one of her colleagues, Favorito, liked to paraphrase, exploiting the past to create a better profit margin. If they couldn't use it, swap it or sell it, they didn't care about it.
Yep.
So,
and we see that through the entire B5 universe, that IPX is just that
yep.
way.
So ultimately,
yeah, we
ultimately everybody becomes a shadow agent.
Yeah.
And they go into
pretty much
go into training. Now, you remember when John went to Zahadum and Morden was there and Anna was there. And then there was that third, the old guy. What was his name? Justin?
Justin, I think.
Yeah.
I keep trying to say Jacob, but it's like, no, that's Lost.
Yeah, I think it was Justin, but I don't remember. I don't recall the last name. I was kind of surprised not to see his character on Zahadum. Or did I miss something?
You did not.
Okay.
He's not there. He didn't need to be there. And it goes right with what you were saying. She didn't put things in just to put it in as a necessity. So where he came from, why he was there, how he was recruited, all of that remains one of the mysteries.
Well, he would have had to arrived with the Icarus.
Mm, did he?
I don't see. And that's just it.
What was it necessary?
We don't know.
I don't know.
Because the shadows have been out and making the other contacts of theirs as well.
Yeah. I would have liked to have known a little more about that, though. So, you, are we done with the story then? That's pretty much what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, even our discussion is not doing it justice.
No.
I mean, you listeners out there, you need to read this. If you can get a hold of it, you need to read it because it's good.
This is not a hard book to find of the Babylon 5 books. This is not a hard book to find. And if you pay a few extra bucks over the $6 or $7 that it used to cost, it's really worth it. If you want good quality, if you really want a good read.
Yeah. I read it in 2 days. Uh-huh. That was so JP, you want to take us through themes?
Yes. We've been dancing around them. The ones that stood out to me were, I had already mentioned John's devotion to Earth Force. We see that as he kind of corrects and disciplines the junior officers as he's going through those issues with them. The deep and intense love between John and Anna, I kind of already mentioned that. We've talked a lot about it. That added just some amazing depth to that relationship and both characters, and also turned Anna's story into a sad, you know, from sad to for me, tragic.
Yeah. You know, though,
the shadows,
you know what, as far as that point is concerned, John and Anna, I don't know about you guys, but some of the descriptions in the book made me feel uncomfortable.
You're talking about, their exchanges with each other,
that and the thoughts that were going through their heads. I
can't see why, but of course there are also the thoughts of a couple who have hardly seen each other, a married couple who's hardly seen each other for a year.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of almost felt like it was, oh geez,
a little too private.
Yeah. I thought it went too private. I felt more like a voyeur than I did. You know, they didn't say anything. There was nothing in the book that was not appropriate, that was inappropriate or out of line. But yeah, it just seemed to go on an awful private level for me.
So the depth and color of the relationship I referenced for you included a little blush.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good okay. way of putting it, JP.
And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because it really hammers home what you said, a deep, intense love between them two.
I think if they had taken it further than what they did, it might have crossed the line. But if it had gotten any further, it was enough. That kind of voyeurism is... The way this was written, I think, to get to the kind of, you know, level, the voyeurism you felt, it was a result of the depth of the relationship.
Yeah.
What they were, you know, the exchanges and the anticipations wasn't seedy or unseemly. It was just that personal and private.
Yeah.
But that just kind of made that just kind of helped highlight the tragedy of it all.
Yeah. So
these guys, we got to watch one of the two sayings about separation from the one you love come into play. You know, the one you hear these depending on context pretty frequently, I think, across time, but one is absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Yes.
And we're watching that with these two. The flip side of that coin is out of sight, out of mind, and we're just watching a lot of absence makes the heart grow fonder. And I didn't get uncomfortable, but I get it. I understand what you're saying. And
yeah.
And it was right on the edge for me. If it had been any more personal, it probably would have, I would have had the same reaction.
It'd been a little over the line. Yeah. What it did do, Jim, think back in the series, one of the things that had been tearing up John for 2 years at the point where it comes up in the series, actually more than 2 years, I guess, because it came up a couple of seasons into that. And so somewhere between 3 to 4 years was he didn't say, I love you, in his last conversation with her.
Yeah. And the book made a yep.
and
big
this
point.
Really.
The mm-hmm. book made a huge point how important that was to both of them.
Yep. But it was that personal, it was that look into their private thoughts and the private thinking that really helped hammer that issue home.
Yeah. So moving along.
So, yeah. So John and Anna, John's devotion and professionalism for Earth Force and all that that means, the uniform he wears. The shadows being ancient, this ancient and apparently ever involved species that's out there. And this is a cool glimpse into one of the first contacts, if not the first contact for humans. Of course, we saw the Minbari knew exactly what they were stumbling into and tried to get them to wave off.
Mm-hmm.
But the theme of the shadows and ultimately the war starts all the way back here, with this being a prequel to the pilot. The Vorlons, Kosh is almost not of consequence in this, but there are the Vorlons too, right there, another ancient and evolved and notoriously quiet in terms of the public noise they make, species that was out there.
Not of consequence, the last... JP, if I may, not of consequence, yeah. But... one of Sheridan's questions that he had asked but never got an answer, for us at least, was answered.
Which
when
one was
he
that?
Asked Kosh, how did you get this? When Kosh showed him the recording.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
yeah.
And that explains that, but what isn't explained here is why Kosh just stood by and observed and recorded.
No, that part at least is easy. A, he's a Vorlon, and B, he's going to avoid something that could be a direct confrontation with the shadows, and hopping down onto their home territory would probably cross that line.
But you know,
remember, at this point, they're still acting; they're doing everything through others.
Think about the ships that we saw the Vorlons using in that in that battle on the TV show. Why didn't they just call in a strike on that planet? It'd have been over. It would have been all over.
Hey, that was Lorien's actually Lorien's home world, and not necessarily the Shadows. The Shadows had kind of adopted it. So it's sort of a holy place both for the Shadows and the Vorlons. But remember, they're both supposed shepherds, and they're acting entirely through others.
Yeah. So one more point you have, JP. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, runs from this novel all the way through the TV series is the, I guess in the follow-up stuff, including novels, but the post-war tension in the human-Minbari relationship. And we see that demonstrated here, if nowhere else, when Delenn engages and says, there's a ship heading for Alpha Omega 3, you need to stop them. And, you know, the humans kind of him and haw, and they, you know, and there's a try, but it didn't really work out. And she says, well, if another ship goes over there, we're going to consider it an act of war. She was very blunt, and we know why. You know, looking back with this, all that we know about the shadows, but that it was neat to see that stage gracefully set here in this prequel.
Mm-hmm.
So a theme that reaches on through the television show and the movies. Those are the ones that really leapt out at me.
Yeah.
How about you guys? Any to add or?
I think you about covered it all.
Not our standard fare. The first set of books had themes that kept repeating.
Yes.
Well, like I said, this becomes the standard for the rest of the books.
Yeah.
It reinforces the. Go ahead,
well, Jim. I was going to say the books that we've read prior to this have all been quite formulaic.
Yes.
You know, this happens and this happens and then this happens and just fill in the blanks. This is not like that at all.
Those were, to me, it seemed unfamiliar authors who followed the guidance that they were given. This author knew the story. And obviously, we've discussed it, had a relationship in the development of the story with JMS. So,
and apparently, she was also a fan of the series.
Yeah. Well, if she was not, I'm even more impressed because she writes like this, you know, from the heart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how about plot points, Raul?
Well, these themes actually kind of really cover for me, hands down, my favorite part of the plot obviously is the backstory behind the expedition to Zahadum. All of the things that we've been wondering through the series, what happened? How did we awaken the shadows prematurely? Who got Morden to work for them? How did Kosh get that recording of the expedition, which is actually pretty minor? These were always big questions in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do we get those answered, the fact that you can feel sorry for Morden is just brilliant, as is what it finally took to break him. I mean, meaning his family, the way the shadows used his family. And there were two other things that really stood out for me. One of them I've kind of mentioned, and that first is Anna's reaction and her thinking when she was in the rover control pod.
Mm.
I mean, the foreshadowing there was just chilling. And the second is, the last is probably going to sound a little silly. President Santiago's dedication speech, I loved it because he's going through and pulling in all of these elements from the various opening monologues, pulling in the principles. And I just thought that was neat the way Cavelos did that. So, JP, what about you?
This was hard for me because the earlier novels were, I'll be blunt, they were bad enough that when you had a shiny moment, a shiny plot point happen, it stood out. This was all so good, it was hard. If I had to pick one, it would be how the discovery of the shadows unfolds. So maybe more broadly, I'd say it's the Anna's story part of the novel. We've talked about this already, and I think I said it was going to come up later, but we get to see the shadows, but they're never called that. But the way that Cavelos used darkness and the word shadow was really well done. It wasn't like, oh, and here's a great place, I'll just drop the word shadow in, and it'll be a foretelling of... She just wrote a great story and very gently put all the stuff in there that you would hope would be in there to make you go late. Well, made me conclude later, that's why they end up calling them the shadows. Not because, well, maybe because they had an unpronounceable name, but you know, humans tend to want to label things. And at some point you go, it's always darkness and shadows with these guys, these shadows, let's call them shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned before, it's, I was glad she didn't do that in the book. She just let you walk away with that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it. I think Anna's story, and in particular, the descriptions of the realization that the shadows were there, they were alive, it wasn't a dead culture, and then how the story of them unfolded in the novel.
Yeah. So,
what about you, Jim?
Well, the shadows remained in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
They did.
So,
and they operated from the shadows.
Yes. So when I watched the show, I always wondered how the story on Zahodun would flesh out, you know? And we got hints when Sheridan would talk about Anna on those rare occasions when that happened. But, you know, I was very happy to see Morden as a human and found his story to be really, really sad, you know, with his family, losing his family and everything. But I was impressed with the way he handled his grief. He wasn't over it, but he learned to live and go on while still grieving, you know, and it shows that he was a strong person.
Yeah, and remember, this story only happened 6 months after her death.
Yeah.
Or his wife and daughter's death.
Yeah.
So he's right in the middle of that grief period.
Yeah. And, you know, it shows maybe also that he was using his work to help him deal with his feelings, you know. But as one of the most despised characters on the show because of his meddlings in the affair with others, this story really brought home what a victim he was, you know. And then he victimizes Londo, you know, and all the others that had traveled aboard the Icarus to Zahadoom, how some of them wound up being in the hierarchy, like Anna and Morden, and others probably just wound up as the power source for the Vorlon, or excuse me, the shadow vessels. So those were some of my favorite things.
Mm-hmm. The one contrast, Jim, is at the end of the day, in a way, yeah, he's a victim, but he made made his choice. Anna essentially fought to the very end. And what we find out in the series, she didn't break. The brain was basically reprogrammed.
Yeah. Well, so was Morden's, you know.
No, he submitted.
Well,
through his grief.
To being transformed into what he became. But Anna had it done forcibly. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
You know, but the outcome is the same for both of them. They're shadow agents, and what they were before doesn't count. They are essentially dead. So anyway, should we move in? Mm-hmm. Let's move into our favorite quotes. And,
okay.
JP, why don't you headman this one?
All right. I got a couple here. Run with this one first from the favorite plot point or region in the book. This is from Alpha Omega 3 or Zahadoom. The cave walls behind Churlstein, dark in shadow, began in vertical bands to shift. The cave was no longer empty of light, it was filled with darkness. Anna recognized the solid structural movement of bodies. They were bodies of darkness. Darkness is a positive presence. The darkness gathered. In its shifting, fibrous movement, a shape momentarily suggesting a limb, another a head.
Hmm.
And I just thought that was my favorite description of what we know are the shadows from the book, and there were other good ones. The second one takes us over to the Sheridan storyline, or his part of the other storyline, and how he was dealing with these officers, these young officers, which we talked about. He's talking to Ross, Spano, and Whatley, and here's what he says. What counts is not what other people think of you, but what you are and what you do. You are responsible only for yourself. What's important is not convincing them of your integrity, but convincing yourself. Maintaining your integrity when you're alone, when no one will know but you. So you can look in the mirror at the end of the day and think, I did my best. I did my duty. And not there, but related to it, as we were talking about Anna and her decision to depart on the expedition, and we didn't talk about, you know, obviously she talked to Sheridan about that later, and it worked out well in terms of schedule, didn't work out well in terms of the future. Comparing those three young officers' attitudes about their duty to Anna's, there was a point, well, it was the point relatively early in the book where she's approached and told that she needs to go along as the second in command on the expedition. And it was at Chang's, I think it was Chang talking to her, said, it's not a matter of what they want or what I want. I need you to go as science officer, second in command under me. And of course she says, of course. And I thought, man, the comparison of her reaction as a subordinate to him as the captain versus these three kids that I'd almost call punks in some regard, and their reaction to authority, their captain, it was quite a contrast.
Mm-hmm.
So, that last quote and that comparison I made wasn't really a favorite quote, but the second quote I gave there about Sheridan telling the boys what counts is not what other people think, I thought that was phenomenal.
Yeah. And you know something? That is a long-winded version of something I tell my students once in a while. I just simply tell them, look, your character is determined by what you do when nobody's watching.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep. I'll go next, save you for last, Raul, if that's okay.
Oh, gee, thanks. Go for it.
So, the telepath that Anna called in, Terrence Hilliard was his name, he comes in to scan this mouse that what Anna refers to, and she asks him to scan it and to try to learn something, and he says to her, you know, you could fill a thimble with what I know about archaeology, but I have to say, I don't think I'm going to be able to sense anything, let alone be able to order it to or order it around to fetch your slippers. So this is a
mistake of the century.
Yeah. Well, this is an unusual telepath because he's not showing the ego that we are used to seeing with a telepath. Right. It's like he's just a regular working guy and he's been called in to do this little job. So,
mm-hmm. He's just a commercial thief, like you said.
Yeah. It's kind of refreshing.
Especially in the books.
Yes. So, down to you, sir.
Well, I actually had, like JP, I had two quotes. One of them was a little bit sort of on the lighter side. One of them was a little bit very much in line with what JP had pointed out. The first one was actually something Dr. Morden had said. You know, Dr. Morden versus Mr. Morden, what... They really are, in some ways, they're the same person, but they're two different people, a before and after.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on a translation on the what they call the egg, sort of the shadow's booby trap.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'm not really sure on this. My tentative translation is what is desired, though it may say all that is desired. I'm sitting there thinking, Hey, Morden, why don't you try what do you want?
I remember reading that and thinking the same thing.
Yep.
What do you want?
And that is just one of the ways she doesn't throw stuff out to do it. She's building on it. She's actually using the mythology of the Babylon 5 universe. And the second one. This is John Sheridan after he's talked Ross down from shooting himself in dejection. Sheridan says, well, I'm not going to let you off so easily, mister. I want you to serve Earth Force in the place of those 36 men and women who can't anymore. I want you to earn that rank you carry. I want you to perform the duties you should have been performing. I will accept no excuses. I will tolerate no less than excellence. I want your section to become an example for this entire ship. If you've been poisoned, then spit it out and be done with it. You have a debt to pay, and I'm going to see that you pay it in duty and in honor. Okay, yeah.
Right on.
It's a little more Hollywood than real world military, I know, but it is John Sheridan. It's one of the most John Sheridan moments of the book. Right up there with the quote that JP gave and the Sheridan's acts at the end trying to stop that, trying to stop the bombing.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I love that quote.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So I guess that almost pretty much takes us up to some closing items.
Yep.
Mine's actually fairly short. So if you want me to, if I can lead off, I'll lead this one off.
All right.
It's short. Yeah, it's sweet. And it's that this book really is a reset of the novels like JMS promised. It sets the bar for everything to follow. It not only fits the canon of the series, it enhances it. And I just mentioned mythology. It really deepens your understanding and as a reader, your relationship with the mythology.
Oh yeah.
And
it puts in a huge piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's it. I'm going to pass it off to you guys.
All right. Well, I'll go next. This is just a great story in every way. I appreciated the way the author, I appreciate a way the author used just what was needed to tell without feeling the need to go into depth on every single detail of every character, you know? Mm-hmm. I like the way the shadows were referred to without being named. This was truly a story intended for fans of Babylon 5. Only a fan could appreciate the story to its fullest, because the reader would really have to know the show in order to get everything out of it. This would not be something I would recommend to someone who is not intimately familiar with the Babylon 5 universe. So, consequently, I'm just going to call this book a 5. I don't know if that...
Ah, you're jumping ahead.
Oh, well, usually it, it's okay. Usually it's our closing thoughts and a rating, yeah. But at any rate, I'm going to rate it a 5. So I don't know if the previous books are shadowing that, you know, are part of the reason I'm calling it that. But I really enjoyed the book immensely and thought it was purely Babylon 5.
Yep. I would agree with all of that.
So, and what was your rating for the book?
Me? Yeah. Okay. Well, you referenced it to things shadowing. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you put it, I've read all of the book series before. So actually in foreshadowing, in foreshadowing, it was a real tear up between a 4.5 and a 4.75. And I kind of went with just doing it by halvesies, since that's kind of how we've done it. So I had to give this book a 4.5, but understand that's based on my knowing what is to come.
Okay.
Take that as some hints to what you are going to be in for.
Oh, well,
folks,
I've read some of them already. So
indeed.
So I know that we're going to be looking at some neat stuff. And JP, your closing thoughts and rating.
I liked how the author bounced back and forth between the two storylines. The first time I remember seeing an author do that was probably Tom Clancy's first novel back when that came out, where you get immersed in one part of the story and suddenly you're dealing with another part. And in this book, you know, we look at a section that would talk about, you know, life on the Agamemnon, whatever was going on. And it would end, and I'd think, man, I can't wait to get through the Alpha Omega stuff so we can get back to this. And then I would be reading the Alpha Omega section, the next chunk of that story, and it would end, and I'd have the same reaction. Oh, man, I can't wait to get through the Agamemnon stuff so that I can get back
would
to this.
Would that Tom Clancy book you're referring to be called Red Storm Rising?
That's what I was going to ask him, Jim.
Yeah.
My favorite Tom Clancy book.
Mine, too.
Yes, indeed. So I just really enjoyed that. Every time I would be disappointed at the finishing of a part of the story and one storyline, and then equally disappointed when the next part from the other storyline would wrap up. It made reading it fast. It was exciting. Well done. It was just highly recommend this book.
Yep.
And I would the rating I had written down when I finished it is the one I'm sticking with, and that was a 4.5.
All right. So that gives us an overall rating of 4.7.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Awesome.
So, which we're all right in the ballpark with that.
Yep.
Goodreads had 390 ratings, and it came out at a 3.83 on Goodreads.
Yeah, not bad.
Not bad.
And Amazon...
That team seems to be a tough crowd.
Yeah. And Amazon only had 33 ratings, but they seem to agree with both of you guys at a 4.5. So just as a comparison.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, since Amazon bought Goodreads, it can say that there were a total of 300 and... Whatever, 423 ratings.
Oh. okay. Well, yeah, you know.
I'm just kidding.
Well, and I'm sure there's probably some crossover there that, you know, the Amazon people went over and also did the same thing on Goodreads, but
right.
I think it's worth something.
Yeah.
So what do you think, guys? Any boom today?
Do you mean physical, literal boom, or do you mean emotional boom, or do you mean psychic boom?
I think we at least had some mouse boom, and I think we had some psychic boom.
Yeah. Well, let's...
And some emotional boom.
Let's just take an average of the various kinds of boom and say yay or nay.
I put this 4.75 on the 5 scale of boom.
So we had some boom.
Boom, 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 boom.
Yes.
Yeah.
But are we going to have boom tomorrow?
I don't know. What do you think, JP?
I think we'll have boom tomorrow.
And why is that?
Because there's always boom tomorrow.
Well, you know what? Boom, boom. Looks like we're having some boom.
Yep. So good night, everybody.
Hey, wait, what are we...
Yeah, we can't say goodbye yet.
What are we reading next?
Pretty soon. Well, our next novel that we will be reading is a novel number 8 called Personal Agendas by Al Sarantonio, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, so Sarantonio.
That's what we're looking at. So, now you can say goodnight.
All righty. Well, in that case, hey, this was a great talk. We actually had a good conversation, and the book was great.
I think
right on.
It only took us 7 books to get there. But like I said, we got a lot more coming.
Yes.
So yeah, good night, everybody.
Say good night, JP.
Good night, JP.
So long, everybody.
Podcast terminated.
Thank you for listening to the Babylon Project podcast. You can email Raul and Jim at thebabylonprojectpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at the Babylon Project Podcast. On the internet, we are at babylonprojectpodcast.wordpress.com. To subscribe to the podcast, you can find us on iTunes, or you can subscribe to the RSS feed on the webpage.